Imagine this. It's the end of a long uni day. You're on your way back home as you sit slumped in a semi-crowded train, allowing the noises of the other passengers to rush over you. You get off at your stop. It's late evening and the sun has set, leaving only the yellow streetlights to illuminate your short walk back home. You tap off your Opal card and begin to stroll through the empty streets. Then out of nowhere, something knocks you back. It takes you a second to register the tall figure that has appeared before you, and another second for you to realize that he has punched you in the gut. Winded, you stumble back and are faintly aware of the ethnic slurs that the man is spitting in contempt as you regain your composure. You look up to face your attacker, but he's already gone. You spot two silhouettes in the distance. One throws a final racist turn back at you as he jogs away. His accomplice's jeering laughs are still audible as they both disappear into the distance. For some, this is an all too common occurrence to witness and read on the news. For others, it's a terrifying possibility that is always occupying the back of our minds. But what can we do if we become victim or witness to racial hate, aggression, or discrimination? Are Australian laws set up to address such occurrences? And does it do so effectively? Hi there, and welcome to the latest episode of Footnotes, a legal podcast run by students for students, breaking down the law and all its complexities, one chat at a time. I'm Jacinda.
And I'm Brandon. And on this episode, we will be discussing racial discrimination, vilification, and hate crime laws in both the criminal law and civil law context.
We will also be chatting to Professor Gail Mason, a professor of criminology at Sydney Law School, who is an expert in hate crime and race-based violence.
Our first section of this episode will be on the criminal law aspects of public threats or incitement of violence on the grounds of race. Jacinda, you interviewed Professor Mason. What did you find?
Well, I think the first thing everyone wants to know is what could we do if we ever were the victim of a hate crime?
Well, if someone is the victim of a hate crime, it's probably, in one sense, not that different from being the victim of an ordinary crime. The most action that people would take initially would be to contact the police. So, for example, if you're in New South Wales, you can make a report or a complaint to the New South Wales Police Force. For minor offences, you can actually do that online. But if it's something more serious, you can ring the police assistance line or you can actually just turn up to your local police station. So, say, for example, you were the victim of a racist assault, that would be your first port of call to actually contact the police. But having said that, a hate crime isn't exactly the same as any other crime, you know, because if we think of a hate crime as a crime that's something that's motivated or aggravated by racism or some other form of prejudice like Islamophobia, then if you report that to the police and you're just reporting the assault component, then that's not really taking account of the fact of the fact that it was motivated by some form of prejudice or hatred. So in those circumstances, I would really encourage people to bring that context to the attention of the police. So say you were assaulted or something was thrown at you from a moving car, which is, you know, quite a common scenario. Often the way that you know that it's a hate crime is if the offender says something. They might make a racist comment or there might be racist graffiti on a building, your house or a place where you work. And I would really encourage people to draw that to the attention of the police, because then what they can do is they can actually record it as a hate crime, because the New South Wales Police do have the capacity to do that. So even though it might only, if it goes to court, for example, it might only be prosecuted as an assault, it can actually be recorded as a hate crime. And then that becomes really important, because that helps us understand how common hate crime is, and it helps the police have the right kind of intelligence and data so that they can, you know, they know where to allocate their resources.
But how do you know what you've experienced constitutes a hate crime? You know, for many people, like, there's this inherent fear that reporting a hate crime can be seen as playing the race card or inventing something that isn't really there. The website of the New South Wales Police Force indicates a hate crime is a crime that is motivated by bias or prejudice on the basis of race, religion, sexual orientation, disability, and gender identity. But it can be really difficult to ascertain whether an action or an attack is motivated by this, especially if the incident didn't really involve any verbal assault.
I would think that if there's any hint of racism or some other form of prejudice, then you should report it and you should say that to the police. So ideally, if you were to report a hate crime to the police, what would happen is the investigating officer taking the report would tick the box that indicated that there appeared to be evidence for some form of prejudiced motive, and then that should go through to the hate crime and engagement unit. And in theory, that unit certainly has the capacity to investigate it as a hate crime.
But dealing with the police means having to come up against police discretion, which, as I'm sure most of my fellow law students know, can be a bit of a double-edged sword.
This is a really important and difficult area for policing, because police discretion becomes really important. And if police aren't trained sufficiently to know how to identify a hate crime, or even to remember to ask the victim, oh, was there anything like this involved? You know, should I be ticking that box? Then we're probably going to find that hate crime is very much under-recorded.
Yet even if we do manage to get past the reporting stage, what laws can we actually rely upon to incriminate racial hate crime? Well, according to Professor Mason, not many.
We have in New South Wales really only one law that covers this area, and that's Section 93Z in the Crimes Act. And that law has only been around since 2018. So what that offence says, it effectively says that if somebody intentionally or recklessly threatens or incites violence through a public act against a person on the basis of their race, their religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, intersex status or HIV/AIDS status, then that may well be an offence under the provision. The maximum penalty, I think, is 3 years imprisonment.
Yet since the enactment of Section 93Z of the Crimes Act in 2018, there have only been two prosecutions. And even both of those failed to secure conviction, as the police had failed to get the consent of the DPP before they proceeded. And while that in itself is just a procedural issue, it remains the fact that it's a very low level of prosecution for a piece of legislation.
I think that it's because the provision is quite a narrowly drafted provision. It really only criminalises threats or incitements to violence, threatening violence or inciting violence, on a fairly narrow set of characteristics. So that doesn't cover, for example, a person who commits an assault because they're motivated by prejudice.
The provision is also just highly underutilised, not just by the police, but also by the actual community.
I think it comes back to the community being informed as well. Because we can ask the police to be proactive, we can ask them to be investigating and looking for public acts that threaten or incite violence on the basis of race, etc. But that's also a tall order for the police, isn't it? They have, as I say, have limited resources. And whilst they may be undertaking that kind of work, we also need members of the public to step up and to identify these incidents and to report them to the police.
But let's take a step back. If people of colour are experiencing hate crimes, and they are, like a quick Google search to do with the Asian and Australian discrimination since the coronavirus outbreak will show you that there are many incidents going on, then why is it not being reported? In fact, there is compelling research in Australia that shows that hate crime overall is severely underreported.
There are other reasons that are quite specific to hate crime as to why they're underreported. And one of the major reasons is that if you think about who are the main victims of hate crime, largely it's people from racial, ethnic, religious, sexual or other minorities, like people with a disability. And for some of those communities, the history of those communities with police is quite a vexed one. So there is sometimes a lack of trust amongst communities towards police. So two classic examples here would be the Muslim community and also the Aboriginal community. Both of those communities feel that they have been unfairly treated by police, that they have been the recipients of over-policing and of abusive powers by police. So we know that those communities do not trust police. And when you don't trust police, you're less likely to report. So I think that is one of the major reasons why people don't report hate crime. And then, of course, closely related to that, is maybe a concern. Well, if I don't trust the police, will I have a bad experience? Will they treat my concerns with sensitivity? And all of those factors compound together so that to make hate crime probably one of the least reported crimes.
So it seems even the reporting process of hate crimes can be really difficult to a person of colour. Tackling hate crime is such a complex issue that is not only thwarted by the limited law we have around it, but also there are obstacles that we will constantly find just because of the racial discrimination that is embedded within Australian history and society. But what can we do then? What steps are viable for us to take to lessen the occurrence of hate crime in the present?
We do have to encourage people to take action when they're a victim of hate crime, but having said that, we have to support them at the same time, because if we accept that there's a lack of trust in communities who are most vulnerable to hate crime, then we need to provide support to those communities. Firstly, resources, knowledge. What does a hate crime look like? Where can you go to report it? But also, where can you get support? Who could help you? Who could go with you? Who could translate for you? Those sorts of issues. So we need the dual mechanism of support and encouragement to report.
In fact, Professor Mason herself is working on such a mechanism.
So recently, through the University of Sydney and in partnership with the Australian Hate Crime Network, I've received a grant from the City of Sydney to produce an online guide for understanding and reporting hate crime. So what that guide will do is it'll be a website, but it'll have social media tiles, it'll have a toolkit, it'll have resources for people so that they can firstly understand hate crime, so that they can put that name to it, and then they can see, oh, well, here's where I could go for support, here's where I could go to report it. And so the idea is to support communities at the same time that we're helping them to be active in the fight against hate crime.
The idea of having a hate crime committed against you is obviously something that we never want to face ourselves. But I think it's really important that we understand the law and the mechanisms that are available to us should it ever happen. We've now covered the criminal law aspects of racial discrimination, vilification, and hate crime laws. So let's move on to more civil remedies. Brandon, what options do people have?
We'll start by looking into the Race-Based Discrimination Acts at both the Commonwealth and state level. Then we will look over how the anti-discrimination bodies, the Human Rights Commission, and the Anti-Discrimination Board use these laws to resolve complaints. And finally, we'll touch briefly on how the court system is involved in adjudicating race-based cases.
Australia's racial discrimination laws are regulated at both a state and federal level, with the Racial Discrimination Act at the Commonwealth level and the Anti-Discrimination Act at the state level. Brandon, what are the similarities and differences between the two laws?
Well, starting with the Commonwealth Racial Discrimination Act, it outlines what acts are unlawful if they discriminate or engage in offensive behaviour because of race, colour, or national or ethnic origin. Now, these provisions are contained in Part 2 and Part 2A of the Act. So starting at Part 2, in Part 2, Section 9, Subsection 1, states that it is unlawful for a person to do any act involving a distinction, exclusion, restriction or preference based on race, colour, descent or national or ethnic origin, which has the purpose of essentially breaching a human right or fundamental freedom. Now, further parts of Part 2 outline specific situations whereby discrimination is also unlawful. Then turning to Part 2A, offensive behaviour based on racial hatred is made unlawful. And this part includes the infamous Section 18C, which in subsection 1 states, it is unlawful for a person to do an act otherwise than in private if A, the act is reasonably likely in all the circumstances to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate another person or a group of people, and B, the act is done because of the race, colour or national or ethnic origin of the other person or of some or all of the people in the group. Now, Section 18C was the subject of quite a fierce public debate in 2016, where politicians sought to reduce the scope of the offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate phrase, but that section of the Act has not yet been amended.
So that's at a Commonwealth level. What about for New South Wales in particular?
In New South Wales, the relevant Act is the Anti-Discrimination Act of 1977. Now, the whole of the Act covers a wide range of discrimination, such as sex discrimination, discrimination on transgender grounds, disability, age, and of course, race. Part 2 of that Act sets out the racial discrimination provisions. In Section 7, racial discrimination is defined as discrimination based on race or imputed race, where someone is treated A, less favourably than someone of a different race, or B, is segregated from people of other races, or C, is required to comply with a requirement that is not reasonable in the circumstances and which the person does not or is not able to comply. The rest of Part 2 sets out specific settings where discrimination is also unlawful, including at work, in education, accommodation, and the provision of goods and services.
Okay, so now let's chat these government-established bodies that work to solve discrimination problems. Which one is bigger and which one has a bigger workload?
The Federal Human Rights Commission is the larger one, and in the 2018-19 financial year, they dealt with 2,037 complaints of discrimination across the board, with 2,307 complaints received in 2019-20. Unfortunately, they do not provide specific race discrimination case stats in their annual reports. But looking at the success rate of the Human Rights Commission, in 2019-20, 70% of complaints sent to conciliation were successfully resolved, slightly down on the 72% in 2018-19. And 46% of all complaints generally were resolved by conciliation. That was 47% in 2018-19. Moving to New South Wales, and the Anti-Discrimination Board gives more specific numbers, with the 2018-19 financial year seeing 149 race discrimination complaints received by the ADB and 147 for the 2019-20 financial year. But back now to the general numbers for all complaints in general finalised in 2018-19, only 63.3% of complaints were finalised within 6 months of receipt, and in 2019-20, that was 67%. And for that portion that was finalised, only 41.1% of cases were settled or referred to the Civil and Administrative Tribunal, with the rest abandoned, withdrawn or declined. That number was even less at 37% for 2019-20. Now, with these numbers, it's important to note that the ADB only has 32 staff at the end of June last year.
Can you take us briefly through the process for both bodies to get a conciliation conference?
Sure. Starting at the federal level, the Australian Human Rights Commission only accepts written complaints submitted online, posted or faxed to them. The Commission will then consider whether what has happened could be unlawful discrimination and may contact the complainant and the other party for further details. If, at any point, the Commission decides to stop investigating a complaint, they will let a complainant know why. Then, the Commission will speak to you about trying to resolve the complaint via conciliation and will help organise it if you give consent. In a similar fashion to the Human Rights Commission, Anti-Discrimination New South Wales also only accepts complaints in writing. The information that should be in the letter or complaint form are listed on the Anti-Discrimination New South Wales website and include the names of people involved, details about the incident, the type of discrimination and the resolution you seek. Next, Anti-Discrimination New South Wales will review the complaint to see if it is covered by anti-discrimination legislation. If it is, it will be allocated to a complaint handler who will gather further information from both sides. If after an assessment, the claim still appears to involve unlawful discrimination, a conciliation conference will be organised. And similarly to the Human Rights Commission, if Anti-Discrimination New South Wales finds that the complaint does not appear to involve unlawful discrimination, they will write to the complainant explaining why.
And what about if someone wants to take a matter to court?
If someone wishes to go to court in the first instance to resolve a complaint without the use of the Anti-Discrimination Board or Human Rights Commission, then usually they must have standing under an act that's not the Anti-Discrimination Act or Racial Discrimination Act. This is because these acts allow for the conciliation of claims that may not fall into a well-defined legal relationship. However, one example of what is a well-defined relationship is in the Fair Work Act, which under Section 351 states that an employer must not take adverse action against a person who is an employee or prospective employee of the employer because of quite a few protected characteristics, including race and colour. A breach of this invokes a civil remedy provision, which under Section 539 of the Act attracts a maximum penalty of 60 penalty units, currently set at $13,320. Additionally, the Act provides that further monetary amounts can be sought for pecuniary penalties and interest. On the other hand, if a person is unable to get a conciliation off the ground or an agreement cannot be reached, they can have the ability in New South Wales to have it referred to the Civil and Administrative Tribunal. At federal level, if the complaint can't be resolved through conciliation, you can apply to have it heard by the Federal Court or the Federal Circuit Court.
That's pretty much it for this episode. We've had a lot more content that we couldn't pack in, so if you want to hear more on racial discrimination, vilification, and hate crime laws, get in touch.
Yeah, you can send us an email via podcast@sulz.org.au or slide into our DMs on Facebook and Instagram under the Sydney University Law Society's accounts.
We'd also like to thank Professor Gail Mason for taking time out of her busy schedule to talk to us and provide some valuable insight into the hate crime laws of Australia.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode. To make sure you don't miss our next steps, make sure to subscribe to this podcast in whatever app you're listening to it on right now.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.